Walter Russell Mead says that during the last 300 years, Britain and America have emerged victorious and stronger from every international conflict in which they've been involved. In his latest book, Gods and Gold, Mr. Mead credits their common Christianity as the most important factor in helping those Anglo-Saxon, these two Anglo-Saxon countries to become the world's most prosperous and powerful nations. His book is published by Knopf, and I'm pleased that it brings Walter Russell Mead, the Henry A. Kissinger Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, back to the show today. Hello.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Now, we have to clarify, we haven't really emerged victorious from the Korean War, Vietnam, even Somalia. You're talking about a different kind of victory there?
Yeah, actually, in the book, what I talk, I just make the point that since 1688, if you look at the big great power wars that kind of shaped the international agenda from one generation to the next. You know, the British got beat in Sudan by the Mahdi. I mean, it's not every smaller conflict, but the sort of big agenda-setting ones. Either the British or the Americans or both have been on the winning side in every one since the 17th century.
We pride ourselves on our secular form of government. Our Constitution's First Amendment guarantees the separation of church and state. Are you now allying yourself with the Christian conservatives who claim that we've always been a Christian nation?
Well, you know, that's no. Short answer. Actually, what I want to make really two points about the kind of religious background of the United States. The first is that it is true that historically speaking, though never, and I hope also never legally speaking, this has been demographically considered a, quote, Christian nation, the large majority of people in it being Christian. But the form of Christianity, or rather we should say the forms, have been rather unique because while you have Americans who are extremely dogmatic and closed in their religious attitudes, overall American Christianity has been productive of tremendous diversity and liberty. And in part, it's because of those. It's precisely because of the divisions. You can see it now in this race, where the evangelicals would like to have a majority, would maybe like to nominate Huckabee and go on to win, but there's this sort of nagging feeling, well, there just aren't enough evangelicals to actually get a majority in the country.
Well, there aren't enough anythings to get a majority, although we probably will see a Catholic majority somewhere down the line. But Catholics are not the Christians you're talking about. You're talking about post-Calvinist Christianity,
right?
Aren't you?
Well, what I'm really saying is that there was a kind of a spiritual approach, which actually I think shapes Americans today, many Americans, whether they're explicitly religious or not, that was rooted in a particular understanding of the way religion worked. And, you know, in many religions historically, there's been the sense that there was a golden age in the past, and that that an unchanging rule for life had been laid down through revelation, and in some golden age in the past it was realized, and our job today is to get back to that golden age one way or another. There's this.
The golden age was when God talked to humans.
For some Muslims it's the 7th century in Arabia. Some forms of Hinduism, again, there's the idea that there was once a golden age when God's will was truly done. Or for some Confucians in China, even, there might be this sense of, you know, there was once an era when things were right. And so our goal is to get back to that. But this very individualistic form of Protestantism that took hold in Britain in the 17th century and spread from there to here and continued to develop sort of looks at, in a sense, says, hey, it takes the faith of Abraham as its kind of model, based on really Paul's theology in his epistles. And God's call to Abraham is, leave your father and your father's gods and come with me to a new land, and there you'll meet me. And so there's this sense that the key test for the believer is to reach toward the future rather than to try to return to a past. And what that's meant in an interesting way is it's dramatically reduced the cultural tension in the English-speaking world between religion, which historically, again, is a force for tradition and unchanging society, and then all the sort of upheavals of modernism and capitalism, which, you know, in many societies even today, there's the sense that you must make this tragic trade-off between your values and your past, and then those things that work. They're not spiritual, but they work. And there's been more of a sense in the Anglo-American world that we fulfill our tradition, in a sense, by reaching for the new. Now, this is not dogmatically Christian, nor is it sort of linked, you know, only to Christians or to Protestant Christians in America. It's sort of, it's become a kind of a common cultural subtext in American lives.
But in early Protestantism, in fact, in Calvinism, we make this big switch from making a lot of money is not necessarily good, making a profit off from others is not a good idea. Two, it is a good idea. In fact, if you are wealthy, predestination says that you're one of God's chosen. Is that what's happening here? Is that that's how Christianity, at least that form of Christianity, has helped make capitalism possible?
That there is a piece of that. And actually, Max Weber, who developed this thesis, you know, also pointed out that actually Judaism was a very favorable environment for the development of early capitalism. And I think that, you know, I think we have a combination of this Weberian capitalist drive that comes out of Calvinism and then something that comes more out of evangelicalism or even pietism, this notion of the individual soul reaching into the future for communion with God or fulfillment of destiny.
Isn't your father a well-known Episcopal priest in Washington, D.C.? Does he subscribe to this?
Well, my dad and I don't talk direct theology that much. He does like the book. And in some ways, I suppose, I've been interested that both mainstream and more conservative Protestants have found this an interesting thesis. They tend to disagree with different parts of it. But it's also in the African American church. There's been really a very positive reaction to the book.
Have Americans and the British been able to keep a balance between faith, tradition, and reason that other groups have not? I guess it's called the Anglosphere, isn't it?
Yeah,
the U.S. and the United States.
Well, Britain and America today are very different places. I mean, there's very little religion in British life other than in kind of official established ways. But
people still say prayers in many of the schools. They have chapels still.
Right. And you can't be the head of state. You can't be queen or king unless you are an Anglican. And Prince William can't marry a Catholic girl without permission of Parliament. So in some ways, the British have kind of more structured religion than we do. But in general, the level of Christian commitment or theology in the UK is pretty low. But if you look at the UK that we're descended from, the sort of era of Queen Anne, what you saw was there were kind of three groups in British society. There were these people still loyal to Cromwell who really wanted to build a theocracy. God had in the scriptures revealed the way society ought to be, and that's what we want. There was another group who kind of held that tradition is really the root of the way society should be, the way it's always been, the aristocracy, the monarchy, and for some of them, the Catholic Church. And then there were others who had this idea, no human reason. We shouldn't take just revelation or tradition as guiding us, but we should reason it all out. And the thing is, in England at that time, none of the three could really win. No one could dominate the whole decision-making process, and no one could be driven out of it. And so no one really wanted it, but in the end, they kind of had a society that found itself responsive to all three of these things.
But that's a much of... First of all, I should tell everyone that my guest is Walter Russell Mead, whose latest book is called God and Gold, Britain, America, and the Making of the Modern World, published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The Enlightenment is really where much of our thinking about capitalism comes from, and especially the Scottish Enlightenment. And the Scottish Enlightenment, the two leading figures were called atheists in their time. Smith,
well, plenty
and Hume.
Of people have been called atheists.
And Hume probably was an atheist.
Hume probably was. Smith is a little more, little tougher to figure. But
so they rejected the God in all of this. But the fact that they grew up Christians, in that case Scottish, what were they, Scottish Presbyterians? Was that a factor, even though they may have personally rejected the concept of God?
It clearly does in some way affect their thinking. But my point is, again, that it's not that Christianity dominated it, or that rationalistic enlightenment dominated it, or that national tradition dominated it. Rather, they all found a place. But I, you know, when I look at, for example, Smith's idea of the invisible hand, what I see there, what I see him doing there, is sort of something that basically is a key to Anglo-Saxon social thought long before him and long after. That is, you think about how common law, the English common law, emerged out of hundreds of years of interaction and struggles among different people. You know, whose cow is it? And out of precedent rather than grand principles, gradually this fabric of the law emerges. Is sort of the way that Newton saw that, I mean, that Smith saw that out of economic competition an order emerges. It's really the way Darwin also saw the process of evolution, as, you know, order and complexity emerging out of the unguided play of individual elements. And what this represents in a very interesting way is a kind of a faith in historical processes to bring out a better result without a guiding intelligent control, so that you have a sense in secular terms for Smith and for Darwin. This is a very secular thought, but it corresponds in many ways to this sort of Protestant faith that God is bringing out some kind of better order in the future. It's a sort of a secular analog to the idea of godly guided progress.
You refer often to WASPs in your book. Do you mean specifically white Anglo-Saxon Protestants?
I mean it as a sort of a cultural label, certainly, rather than an ethnic label. And again, one of the interesting things is you can go back to 18th century England and see people mocking and deriding the idea that there was some ethnic, something specially ethnic about the people living in England. It was really a cultural and a political and a social identity. And I think that,
because it's a melange of indigenous peoples and then Angles and Saxons,
right,
and French.
And immigrants from all over Europe. In a best-selling poem published in the UK in about 1702, he didn't even use the phrase melting pot to describe. He says England is Europe's chamber pot, essentially, where all the offal and the refuse is thrown together, and that's who we are. So this idea of an identity that has emerged from many different groups and again, doesn't reflect some kind of guiding plan, but represents our interaction with each other, forming a cultural unity, is actually a very old Anglo-American concept.
And you say it's the way that people identify us. You use the term waspophobe for people who are anti-American.
Right. Again, not just objecting to some...
I wasn't sure whether you were joking when you...
Well, it's a little bit of a sort of more elusive than scientific classification, I think. But there is this sense that people outside the U.S. See the British and the Americans, often call them the Anglo-Saxon powers, because while we British and Americans are extremely conscious of our differences with each other and often even don't like each other very much, people from non-English speaking world have no trouble at all detecting strong family resemblances between us, culturally speaking.
But I wonder about the role of Jews in all of this. Jews were forced, in many cases, into business, whether they wanted to be or not, but succeeded and then were vilified for doing all of the things that you're saying the British and the Americans are great for having done.
And in fact, for at least 100 years, there's been a strong association between Anglophobia, anti-Americanism, and anti-Semitism. You can go back to the Boer War. And the sort of common cry in Germany and France was that this was that the Jewish plutocrats who control the British government behind the facade of parliamentary democracy, the sort of Jewish lobby in got the British into the Boer War in order to protect Jewish gold interests. Gold then played the role in the anti-WASP imagination that oil does today, as the sort of magic commodity that explains all their foreign policy and all their conniving. So the association of Jews, capitalism, and then the leading powers of the English-speaking world as kind of an evil trinity that is in league against human society and human dignity is actually a pretty old one.
Even though anti-Semitism has been a tradition among the upper class in Britain.
Exactly.
You've created a tongue-in-cheek name for methods of power that Britain and America have used, the Protocols of the Elders of Greenwich.
Yeah.
Thinking along these lines?
Well, one thing is that Greenwich in the UK was where the Naval Observatory was, kind of a center of British sea power. Today, Greenwich, Connecticut is where the hedge fund managers tend to live. So it's been associated with the eras of English-speaking power. But there really is a kind of a the U.S. and the U.K. are not just united by a common language, but there's been a sort of a common approach to world politics that has shaped us. I call it the five-point plan for global domination, and in a sense, that's what it's actually been. Number one is you have an open society at home where, you know, sort of careers are open to talent, markets are free, politics are free, intellect is free. The Dutch actually, by the way, invented all this. Neither the English nor the Americans did.
And you talk about a link between the Dutch and Britain. In fact, at one point, the Dutch provided Britain with a king. But
yeah.
New York is often cited as the prime example when the rest of America was, even though it was British, mostly, it was also very, very religiously tied you had to be a member of a religious group to live in certain places. New York was open because the Dutch insisted on it, and has changed. That's made our culture a lot more open.
Peter Stuyvesant actually tried to keep the Dutch from settling in New York, and the Dutch India Company rebuked him sternly.
Said, well, the Jews were coming up from Brazil.
Exactly, and the Dutch said, no, welcome them in, which is what the Dutch did in Holland. The English began to do this when Oliver Cromwell was ruling England, that the Jews had been banned since medieval times, and Cromwell allowed them back in. And then by the end of the 18th century, Disraeli's father was given an honorary degree from Oxford. He couldn't take a bachelor's degree because you had to be an Anglican. But already you're beginning to see, yes, continuing anti-Semitism and prejudice at all levels, but the beginning of this kind of extraordinary cultural synthesis, this mix of Jewish and Anglo culture and enterprise, which if you think about, say, New York finance today, sort of founded on, you know, this Dutch trading post that now has kind of grown into this temple of finance.
Has Christianity also helped Anglo-American society achieve technological advances?
Yes, it has, in the sense, but not, you know, again, not some particular dogma or sect of Christianity. The particular Christian society that we had here was one, again, where no single religious denomination controlled it, so that no one could shut it down the way the Catholic Church was, the Inquisition was able to say, shut down Galileo. I think had one single Christian denomination, whether it was the Anglicans, the Catholics, or any of a number of others, achieved that kind of stable monopoly, they would have probably tried to lock down intellectual thought. Harvard was not a very tolerant place in the 17th century. But again, because we have this diverse and pluralistic mix of different Christian traditions and organizations, we've created a society that has been open sometimes despite itself.
Walter Russell Mead is the Henry A. Kissinger Senior Fellow in U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is the author of a number of books and also has written frequently for the New York Times, the Washington Post, Esquire, and other publications. His latest book, God and Gold, Britain, America, and the Making of the Modern World, is published by Knopf, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Walter Russell Mead, whose latest book is God and Gold, Britain, America, and the Making of the Modern World, published by Knopf. You've devoted a chapter to trying to understand why it seems so difficult to introduce Anglo-American-style capitalism and democracy into Africa and the Middle East. Didn't you support the war in Iraq? Were you at all concerned at the time about the claims being made about how it would facilitate the spread of Western-style democracy to the Middle East?
I did support the war, reluctantly, but I did. And I was concerned about exactly those things.
But not enough to be opposed to the war. What did you think was going to happen with that war? Because you don't write about it much in the book, although I'm sure that everybody who's reading this book sees it as a subtext.
Well, I didn't think about it much. And this is a history of 400 years. It's not really a history of the last three. And it's also trying to explain, I think, the reasons why, liberals as well as conservatives in this country see a kind of a vocation for the United States to go out there and change the world. That it's something, and some people would argue, well, let's accomplish our mission by being a beacon, an example to the rest of the world. And some people would argue, well, let's go out there and make it happen. And yet, what is common there is this notion that there's a kind of a society here which has something to offer the rest of the world, which other people, for their own sake, ought to try to be more like.
Well, why have British and American leaders been so consistently wrong in believing that their mix of commerce, Christianity, and democracy would convert all opponents and put an end to all strife?
Yeah, that's one of the phenomena that engaged me so much in the book is why are we so strong to win all the wars, but then so wrong that it's the end of history after the Cold War.
He changed his mind on that one.
Right. Well, but it wasn't just him. It was a whole sort of a consensus. Again, the Clinton administration very much shaped by we're in the end of history now. We are pushing forward with the last legs of the transformation project. Same after World War II, Wilson at World War I. It's a very old, deeply embedded part of our culture. Look, I think it works for us. And so we assume, we keep coming back to this idea that everybody, it's going to work for everybody. We say, hey, look, it produces liberty, it produces freedom, it makes the world the way we want it, it makes us rich, it makes us powerful. What's wrong with this social model? Who could object? And obviously, other people have a very different experience, both of how it works, how it fulfills or doesn't fulfill their values, and also what the geopolitical consequences of Anglo-American power have been.
So we believe that we're defending and advancing liberty, protecting the weak, spreading democracy, and the people who we're doing this for see cruelty, greed, a ruthless plot against decency and morality.
That's exactly right. And again, this is one of the things...
Are they wrong, we're right?
What I end up saying there is that, in a sense, we're both right, but in rather odd ways. The Anglo-American form of capitalism seems to be irresistible as a kind of a social force. That is to say, you've either got to work out how to find your way in this and make it work for you, or you get overwhelmed. Sort of think of Japan and China in the 19th century. These Western boats, Western technology show up, and both of them face the same challenge, which is, learn to harness this technology and this social system and make it work for you, or other people will be making the decisions about your future. That's real. But it doesn't necessarily mean then that everybody is or should going to do exactly as we would do. And I think one of the interesting things about the French historical experience, they were the first country to sort of go up against the English, and they got beat over and over again sort of from 1688 to 1815. And in the years since, the French concern to maintain identity and independence in a world that's being shaped in ways they really don't want by this English-speaking power system. They've carved out a path that I think actually many other cultures are working on following as well.
Well, if Christianity has been such an important part in the promotion of Anglo-American capitalism, why have countries like Japan, China, India done so well?
Well, for one thing, it's one thing to provide the environment where a system can take root and take shape that's never been seen before. It's another once a sort of a set of technologies and social methods has been developed. It's another to look at them and figure out how to adopt them, how to use them for your own purposes. But it has been a very difficult struggle for many of these countries. And if we think about China's historical experience, you know, it sort of began late in the 18th century to first take a look at this. And it really, you know, even today, China has now made tremendous progress and is a leading economic power. But it's clear that China's path toward finding sort of social institutions and practices that can harness this power and integrate it into Chinese culture and Chinese governance, it isn't over yet. They're still sort of figuring their way forward.
Don't some people in Eastern societies view Westerners as rich and free, but also cold, inhuman, and very materialistic?
That's right, which when I was a kid is exactly the way a lot of Southerners looked at the North, and the way today people from all over the United States look at New York. And so there's this sense of traditional society, pre-capitalist society, is warm and nurturing, but you are sort of stifled by the group and you're trapped in your identity. And then there's capital, in the sort of the capitalist West, which is free, the individual is autonomous, and yet social bonds are weak, and there's some people see kind of a soulless quality to society.
But you're saying that even within the United States, we have those different perceptions. So Americans can be perceived as one thing by the rest of the world and at the same time not see themselves that way.
That's exactly right. We do not see ourselves well as others see us. We don't even see ourselves as well as, you know, as people see us here. A lot of Americans of all kinds of different ethnic groups go to California and find that they're lumped in as Anglos, which is, you know, becomes surprising. You achieve a new identity just by moving a couple of thousand miles to California. So what we have is this kind of situation, again, where this Anglo-American society has created a tremendously dynamic and fluid environment both within the United States and beyond it. And we're constantly being sort of surprised and shocked at how this changes the way people see us.
And you've said that throughout history, Britain and America have misunderstood what their increasing power will mean for the world. Some years back, Richard Leakey's daughter, I've forgotten her first name, suggested that everyone in the world be invited to vote in U.S. presidential elections because they don't just apply to the United States, they apply to the whole world. And when she said that on the show, a lot of angry callers said, who are they to tell us what to do? They missed her point.
Right. Right. And again, all over the world, you do hear people saying very much, who are they, the Americans, to tell us what to do? But you see, it's not even of political institutions. This form of capitalism, you know, that's sort of still denounced in Europe as Anglo-Saxon capitalism, you know, this sort of tougher, wilder version of it. The fact is, it reflects more or less the cultural preferences of, you know, more or less people in the United States. We tended to like this system for a long time. The fact is, if we're pursuing it, that imposes on the whole rest of the world this challenge, again, of adapting to it in some way. It's tremendously undemocratic in that sense that the social preferences of 5% of the world's population are setting the agenda. So again, it's not simply a question of, you know, of military interventions, although they are part of what sets people at us. It's the, you know, feminism becomes a powerful force in American politics, and suddenly we're exporting feminism all over the world, or even technology. You know, the internet gets invented here, and it changes the way people are living all over the world without their consent or input. So we've created this dynamic society which we don't understand very well, which is transforming us in ways we don't fully understand, and then is going out and impacting the rest of the world at all kinds of levels.
Walter Russell Mead's latest book is God in Gold, Britain, America, and the Making of the Modern World. It's published by Knopp. We also have this situation where Anglo-Saxon leaders have often thought, especially at the conclusion of a conflict, that a peaceful new world order was imminent. Woodrow Wilson talking about the war to end all wars, World War One, and it happens again and again. And the end of the Cold War, everything was going to be great because we had a new world order.
Right.
That was the end of all conflict again.
Well, you know, and I'm sure if we reach the point where the last terrorist lays down the last bomb, you know, people are going to be saying, hey, new world order, everything is going to be fine. And the reality is that I think the world is going to continue to change in unpredicted ways. But it's the same if you think about Adam Smith's view that a stable economy, a growing economy emerges out of the random interplay of forces, or the English view that their common law emerged out of all these struggles through their history and their balanced political system of kings and parliaments and courts emerges out of English history without a guiding force. We're constantly believing that an invisible hand, if we're theistic, it's God's hand. If not, it's sort of the laws of nature, the way things are, bringing a better future out of the struggle of the present. That's, in a sense, what makes us powerful and has made us rich and great, but which also means that we so frequently completely fail to understand what's happening right before our eyes.
But many Americans don't like to talk about our power. Why are we so uncomfortable discussing it?
Well, we're really uncomfortable because, first of all, Americans don't like to think of themselves as people who are imposing things on other people. And
it's at odds with our vision, the vision that we have of ourselves?
It
is. As well-intentioned, generous?
But also, you know, I found that when I start talking about what is to me a clear historical fact that the English and the Americans have been dominating world history for 300 years, people say instantly, well, you're a flag waver and you're a chauvinist and you are, you know, all of these other things. Because somehow to raise the facts of it's, I feel that we are a little bit about power the way the Victorians were about sex. You know, they kind of thought that if you raised the subject, you were advocating the practice. But I think that Americans, whatever our political views and whatever we are, whatever our views of American power, we need to take this subject out of the closet and seriously examine it. Because that's really the, you know, we can't make it go away. It won't cease to exist and it won't cease to cause problems around the world simply because we have decided we don't want to pay attention to it.
Has American power diminished since 9/11? We have those conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq that are unpopular throughout the world. And now Europe, the European Union is a more powerful economic force than the United States is for the first time. The dollar is in serious trouble. We look like all of those predictions that it was going to be the Soviet Union or China aren't really going to come through. In fact, we're going to kind of end in that whimper that T.S. Eliot talked about rather than the Big Bang.
I don't think that's right. I think, you know, American
Well, Britain lost its empire and took years of trying to reconcile its new situation in the world.
But I don't actually think we've lost our power. I think we've lost a lot of popularity in the world. But if you really look where most people say the future, the 21st century is going to be shaped, it's going to be shaped in Asia. The U.S. today has stronger and better relations with China, India, and Japan, the three great powers of Asia, than we did 5 years ago or 10. And 5 years ago, we were better than 10, and 10, we were better than 15. We've actually been steadily building a relationship and set of relationships in Asia that I think are actually going to enable us to continue to play a kind of a balance of power role moving forward and promote the economy. It's interesting that in Europe, one of the reasons the European Union is able to act more effectively now is that they've moved closer to the United States. There was sort of a sense of, on the one hand, Putin kind of destroyed the hope that some Europeans, like Gerhard Schroeder, had that Russia might be an alternative partner to the United States. Also at things like the Bali Conference on the Environment, what the Europeans are actually discovering is, A, that the Americans, despite all of our faults and even under Bush, are much closer to the Europeans on issues like the environment than the Chinese and the Indians are, and B, that without support from the Americans, the Europeans have simply zero prospect of affecting the behavior of Asia. So I think what's actually happening is that America is moving out of this sort of temporary mode after the fall of the Soviet Union, when it seemed that there were no other significant international players. And we've now entered a mode where America remains the kind of key force and balance, the one global power in a world of regional powers, sort of the way Britain was in the 19th century. And I think that that may last for some time.
Well, and we're seeing it reflected to some degree in the presidential candidates and how they agree and disagree on so many things. Is the range is kind of extraordinary. My guest has been Walter Russell Mead. His latest book, God and Gold, Britain, America, and the Making of the Modern World, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
And thanks for having me. Look forward to seeing you again.
On tomorrow's show, two men who have been exonerated after years of wrongful imprisonment tell us why it's so difficult to return to the outside world. Also, understanding philosophy through jokes. Our latest States of the Union looks into the election issues that matter in Massachusetts, plus word maven Patricia T. O'Connor. Remember, tomorrow's the last day to submit your photo to our listener photo project. Send us a photo of an object that has special meaning to you. And to find out more, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Scott Goldberg, and Sarah English. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Rory Bernstein, Paula Crossfield, Barbara Kahn, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Zach Marsh was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.